aggressive. Aye, sir, if that nose were mine, I would have it amputated on the spot. Friendly. How do you drink with such a nose? You ought to have a cup made especially. Descriptive. 'Tis a rock.
You're listening to the voice of José Ferrer in a scene from Cyrano de Bergerac. A page from this afternoon's edition of Anthology. This is Fleetwood. Every Sunday afternoon at 3, WNBC, in conjunction with the Poetry Center of the YM and YWHA, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, brings you Anthology, a selection of readings of poets, past and present, and the music to accompany their poetry. Our guest today, Norman Rose of the fifth season, and on records, José Ferrer and Judith Anderson. It would be highly appropriate this afternoon if we were broadcasting from a dim, barren stage, or maybe a proscenium box, or even the star's dressing room, since we're devoting our entire program to poetry of the theater, by the theater, and for the theater. Not, of course, in that exact order. I don't think we'd be taking too big a liberty, however, by referring to WNBC Studio 9C as a stage, since William Shakespeare declared, "All the world's a stage." We may qualify that statement a little. Shakespeare penned the words, and they have since been declared by countless actors. Listen.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. His act being seven ages. At first, the infant mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, and then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face creeping like snail unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace with a woeful ballad made to his mistress eyebrow. And then the soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pod, jealous in honor, sudden and quick to quarrel, seeking the bubble, reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch at side. His youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning again to childish treble that pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange, eventful history, is second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans eyes, sans taste, sans teeth, sans everything.
From a Heritage record, the voice of John Carradine. In the world at large, it's generally accepted that there are four seasons: winter, spring, summer, and fall. Here in New York, however, and specifically in what we call the Garment District, there is the fifth season, the season of slack, the season when busy hands are replaced by busy minds calculating costs and trends for the season to follow. The fifth season is also the title and basis of one of New York's most hilarious stage comedies, which has been running at the Court Theater for more than 14 months. Our guest today is a young actor who is a member of the cast of the long-running hit. He's also a very promising young poet who's been published in such well-known magazines as Discovery and Apos. Norman, I know I'm slaughtering one of the funniest lines in the fifth season, but be our guest, please. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Norman Rose.
Thank you very much, Fleetwood. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me to meet you. I've been an admirer of yours, lo, these many years. I first became acquainted with your work as an actor on The Eternal Light.
Oh, yes, that's a radio program I've done many, many times. I must admit to you, Fleetwood, that I'm a little overwhelmed at my being here because this is a program primarily for poetry. I realize that Draper Lewis, the director of the program, has tried to slant the program today toward poetry of the theater. I personally think that the only relationship at the moment that my poetry bears to the theater, mm-hmm. although it is a relationship certainly, is the fact that I am an actor, primarily an actor. The writing of poetry began in what you might call all seriousness only about a year or a year and a half ago, and some friends of mine read my things and liked them very much. But however, probably one of the questions which you have in mind and which many of my friends are interested in, how is it that I began writing poetry at this late stage in my development, so to speak? I think that there is a reason for it beyond just wanting to say something that can only be said in poetry. I think that these days, where almost all actors are confined rather definitely in the cubicle of what is called realism or naturalism in the theater. This applies to serious plays as well as comedies. All of us actors, and writers too probably, feel that we want to break away from it, kind of, and experiment in form and in more non-realistic and perhaps feelingful, more directly, primitively emotional forms in the theater gives us a chance to do. And I think that possibly that need to do that, and having little opportunity to do it as an actor because there are very few verse dramas done on Broadway, I began trying to write poetry myself, and was very fortunate to be accepted in a number of small magazines at first, and I think that my most important publication so far has been in Discovery Number 3, which is put out by Pocket Books. That came out about, 3 weeks ago. Also, I want to make a kind of demurrer, and that is, whereas Joe Ferrer is reading poetry from Cyrano, and I think a little later in the program, if I'm not spilling the beans, Judith Anderson's going to be doing something with Medea. They are primarily dramatic poetry in the sense that they are dramatic plays written for the theater. My poetry is not that at all. I like to think that each poem has a kind of dramatic tension, which every single poem must have, but it's not written with an idea for theater at all at this point in my development as a poet.
And I should think that the kind of poetry which you write would be considerably more difficult even to read than the dramatic poetry. So why don't you read some of that for us?
Let me try reading one. All right. This one is called Program Note. Pardon me, Program Note, and it is to be published in Experiment. I am a villain, cast to type. My long, inquisitive nose threatens with one cultured snort to gut the electric candle of your prosperity. But can't you see my nose is putty? My back is hunched, my brows are black. My voice, by its oily innuendo, can tell you charming things involving your long and convoluted dreams, the ones that feast on your concentration and prevent your full attention before your television set or at the buyer's convention. But can't you hear my voice is tender? So call me villain, pull my beard, mock my words, but please beware. I can seduce your children by changing the color of my hair. Oh, can't you tell? It's a wig I'm wearing.
That's wonderful, Norman. Come on. Got some more there, I'm sure.
Well, I'd like to read the one that came out in Discovery, if I may. Sun Song with Two Tunes, it's called. My father's breast was on fire. A tiny yellow flame had trouble mounting higher, but burned him just the same. Poor man, he called to me to remove this painful trifle. My eyes were too bright to see if I should blow or stifle. So did nothing to check the ember, saw a sight I would like to forget. I would rather by far remember. He stands there burning yet.
I must say you're not lacking in vivid imagery. More, please.
All right. This was published in Epos, the winter edition of 1953. It's called Speaking Directly to You. Is it too late to speak? To speak this way? Now with the windows out and the sun menacing through the hole in the roof and the birds perched poisonous and ugly on the trees. Speaking directly to you. Dare I say nothing? And can you stop from doing nothing to listen to nothing? It is nothing that I have to say. Only an overpowering need to say it, and only the power to say it, knowing the urgency of the hour. I shake a box of empty words, and you turn because the noise reminds you of a parade, and you have nothing else to do. But which is sadder, the speaker of nothing, or the listener to nothing who brings nothing to the listening? Who can hear a meaning never there? Who can bring a meaning to the empty ear? This is one that is going to appear in Ollivant Quarterly next month, Fleetwood. It's called A Dream Is Its Intention. What did I want to say? Can you wait over the points of this dream, stretching your racked love? Oh, don't rise to leave till I've passed the columns of our house, somehow distorted into public buildings stranded on a graying mall. Was it some other you who dispatched me, seeming to be many, standing there in your robes of black on black? I ran unstumbling over the bony earth. It was some secret for your sake I was carrying to that pocket in the mountain, from which I would look back and wonder what was behind you, what was beyond me. Halfway, mind you, halfway, meeting me as by appointment to terrorize, arrogantly circled his leg into my path. Then, gathering speed, masked himself in a cloak of shards. Part of the landscape now, part of the wind, smiling where lost cities gaped between his teeth. His purpose, the dream's intention, unknowable until the end, like the quality of ecstasy. I arrived there first, at first not turning to look back to you for your approval, but only forward, wondering how into the rock to plant your mission and what could flower. Then I turned to signal my success, expecting strangely to see Arabic rainbows and your sister selves armed with pointers, grossly nodding yes, grossly nodding no. Instead, and very simply, he was there, his whole life usurping the mountain's mouth. Behind him the sandy blueness of renunciation. Before him stood I, an afterbirth of fear. Like the older brother of a smile, he lounged there. His eyes assumed I knew the nature of some pleasurable sin. He was the anchor of the hempen yellow coil he offered, limply the tool for scaling mountains or descending death. So, seeing the way blocked and lacking the power to become wings, a stone cry after lost music become avid bird's beak, breaking the shell of the sky, cracking the shell of the dream, chipped its way out to where you brooded, brooding. Have you waited over the points of this dream, stretching your racked love? What did I want to say? Would you like another one?
Indeed. Yes.
Have we time?
Three or four more minutes, yes.
This one is called The Preparers and is as yet unpublished. The Preparers. So, here is death, somehow on a clean table, surrounded by walls of sassafras, with at least half a dozen helpful embalmists saying, expand your chest so that later you'll have room to breathe. What later? With the tight adhesive of the shroud around my thin black ribs, I must rehearse? Having no air, no room, rehearse my lack of preparation, not even knowing need of preparation? It was always too late to practice breathing, so I will improvise as all others at all times this particular personal suffocation. I will smile, holding in my eyes, and pretend that I am listening to their advice, their immaculate ministrations. I will smile all the time they tell me to give myself room for breathing later. I will be wondering what they are breathing now.
Still more time, Norman.
Fine. This one is called The Sunday Morning. We are sleeping with a wolf, my child and I, his black claws under the pillow clutching our curly hair. We do not know his name. He comes from a sunken forest far away, his green eyes closing sleepily against our snuggling. He will be quiet if his back is scratched, or called father, or the blanket collapsed, and little shrieks run pattering to some other room. This is called The Spies, and it is published in Poetry Book Magazine, the current issue, spring 1954. How gently falls, unbeautied into pieces, ungilded as Croesus before the wish, the separate crisis of our friendly treachery, peeking over the transoms from sleep to wake. And your face unlooked at, and name unasked, we stand together as spies unmasked, the mission untold, its value mighty, strongly human, entirely necessary. This is their invention, the saintly couples. An hour does its work. Their soft Viennese accents, man and wife's presumably, unsurprisingly psychoanalytical, explaining the soft hiss of gas escaping from the undulant head, a speaking microphone unloading the long-drawn words from its heavy heart. We'll be just outside, peeping in at that little window up there in case something should go wrong. We die, and the window says gone wrong. Or live, and the window says gone wrong. So we stand, almost as on a Saturday night in the dry steam room of a Turkish bath, our lives running on little thin legs up the wooden tiers to escape vaporously through the chuckling ventilator. Merriment in the midst of panic, boredom, as having known it never happened before and therefore couldn't be interesting in the midst of terror, not taking the trouble to ask each other's name, look in each other's eye, taking for granted it must be an old school tie. Well, we are both either brave or dead already. The last 10 years don't enter into it. The children are sealed off, have never been born, and one's last exasperated thought is, Mother will be hurt. I didn't drop her a card to tell her about it. Love, your loving husband.
Thank you, Norman. But don't go away, because I'd like you to help set the stage for two familiar and exciting scenes from the Poetic Theater.
I'd love to very much, Fleetwood.
Ladies and gentlemen, just a word concerning next week's edition of Anthology. As our special guest, we're delighted to have a man who's been justly hailed as one of radio's finest talents. He's also a highly successful screenwriter, and next week heads for Hollywood to prepare a film treatment of Hedda Gabler. Next Sunday, we know you'll enjoy hearing Norman Corwin reading excerpts from his radio verse play On a Note of Triumph. And next Sunday, a second treat on records, Charles Lawton reads from the Bible on Anthology. The familiar twin masks of comedy and tragedy are well suited for the two excerpts from the Poetic Theater, which we've chosen for this afternoon's edition of Anthology. Norman, you must be well acquainted with José Ferrer's brilliant stage and screen performance of Cyrano de Bergerac.
Oh, yes, Fleetwood, I've seen it.
Then perhaps you'd be kind enough to set the stage for the famous nose scene from the play.
All right. Well, since this occurs very early in the first act, very little explanation is necessary. Everyone is aware of the fact that Cyrano is very conscious, very sensitive about his nose. Woe betide the man who's foolish enough to pass any derogatory remarks about it. Fleetwood, that's Cyrano over there with a white plume. Look, and if I'm not mistaken, we're about to hear a very foolish young noble say, Ah, your nose is rather large.
Ah, your nose is rather large.
Rather?
Oh, well...
Is that all?
Well, of course.
Ah, no, young sir, you're too simple. Why, you might have said, oh, a great many things. Mon Dieu, why waste your opportunity? For example, thus. Aggressive. Aye, sir, if that nose were mine, I would have it amputated on the spot. Friendly. How do you drink with such a nose? You ought to have a cup made especially. Descriptive. 'Tis a rock, a crag... A cape, A cape? Say rather a peninsula. Inquisitive, what is that receptacle? A razor case or a portfolio? Kindly. Ah, do you love the little birds so much that when they come and sing to you, you give them this to perch on? Insolent. Sir, when you smoke, the neighbors must suppose your chimney is on fire. Cautious. Take care. A weight like that might make you top-heavy. Thoughtful. Somebody fetch my parasol. These delicate colors fade so in the sun. Pedantic. Does not Aristophanes mention a mythologic monster called Hippocampelephantocamelos? Surely we have here the original. Familiar. Well, old torchlight, hang your hat over that chandelier. It hurts my eyes. Eloquent. When it blows, the typhoon howls, and the clouds darken. Dramatic. When it bleeds, the Red Sea. Enterprising. What a sign for some perfumer. Lyric. Hark, the horn of Roland calls to summon Charlemagne. Simple. When do they unveil the monument? Respectful. Sir, I recognize in you a man of parts, a man of prominence. Rustic. Eh? What? Call that a nose? I be no fool like what you think I be. That there's a blue cucumber. Military. Point against cavalry. Practical. Why not a lottery with this for the grand prize? Or, parodying Faustus in the play, was this the nose that launched 1,000 ships? These, my dear sir, are things you might have said had you some tinge of letters or of wit to color your discourse. But wit, not so. You never had an atom. And of letters, you need but three to write you down. An ass.
But...
And moreover, if you had the invention here before these folk to make a jest of me, be sure you would not then articulate the 20th part of half a syllable of the beginning. For I say these things lightly enough myself about myself, but I allow none else to utter them.
These arrogant grand airs. A clown who... But look at him. Not even gloves. No ribbons. No lace. No buckles on his shoes.
I carry my adornments on my soul. I do not dress up like a popinjay, but inwardly I keep my daintiness.
But
I have no gloves. A pity, too. I had one, the last one of an old pair, and lost that. Very careless of me. Some gentleman offered me an impertinence. I left it in his face.
From high comedy, a scene from Cyrano de Bergerac, to high tragedy, the concluding moments from Medea, starring Miss Judith Anderson. Norman?
Well, vengeance generally leads to violence, Fleetwood. Vengeance fanned by consuming hatred and jealousy leads to one of the most terrifying moments I know that I've ever spent in the theater when I saw Miss Anderson in Medea. The story of the play is a portion of the legend of Jason and the Golden Fleece. Under threat of being banished from Corinth, Medea gains a stay of 24 hours. In her tortured, hate-filled mind, she's formulated a terrible plan of revenge against Jason, the father of her two sons, who is preparing to marry the princess Gloss. To Gloss, she sends a poisoned robe. And later, when Jason, stunned by the crime, seeks her out, he finds Medea has murdered her own beloved children to punish their father and save them from the disgrace of illegitimacy.
It is done. It was destined when she was born. Now it is done.
Who is coming? Oh. Jason!
Where is that murderess? Where is Medea? Tell me at least whether she took my boys with her. I'll take my sons away to the far end of the earth. Is she lying in there? Open, open, open. Help me to break the bolt.
What feeble night bird overcome by misfortunes beats at my door? Can this be that great adventurer, the famous lord of the seas?
It is done. It was destined when she was born. Now it is done.
Who is coming? Oh. Jason!
Where is that murderess? Where is Medea? Tell me at least whether she took my boys with her. I'll take my sons away to the far end of the earth. Is she lying in there? Open, open, open. Help me to break the bolt.
What feeble night bird, overcome by misfortunes, beats at my door? Can this be that great adventurer, the famous lord of the seas and delight of women, the heir of rich Corinth?
What's that stain on your hand?
The wine I was pouring for you spilled on my hand. Dear were the little grapes that were crushed to make it. Dear were the vineyards.
I came to kill you, Medea. Like a caught beast, like a crawling viper. Give me my sons that I may save them from Creon's men.
I'll let you look at your sons. Bring them across the doorway that he may see them.
I knew it already. I knew it before I saw it. No wild beast could have done it.
I have done it because I loathed you more than I loved them.
Did you feel nothing? No pity, are you pure evil? I should have killed you the day I saw you.
You had love and betrayed it. Now, of all men, you are utterly the most miserable. As I of women.
Only give me my boys, the little pitiful violated bodies, that I may bury them in some kind place.
To you, you would betray even the little bodies, coin them for silver, sell them for power. No.
Let me touch their dear flesh. Let me touch their hair.
No, they are mine. They are going with me. Go down to your ship, Argo, and weep beside it. That rotting hulk on the harbor beach, drawn dry as strand, never to be launched again. Even the weeds and the barnacles on the warped keel are dead and stink. That's your last companion and only hope. For some time, one of the rotting timbers will fall on your head and kill you. Meanwhile, sit there and mourn, remembering the infinite evil and the good that you made evil. Now I go forth to wander under the cold, clear eyes of heaven, those weakness-despising stars. Not me they scorn.
And so we ring down the curtain on this afternoon's edition of Anthology. Our sincere thanks to Norman Rose for paying us a visit. Next week, as previously promised, Norman Corwin reading from his brilliant radio play On a Note of Triumph. Anthology comes to you with the cooperation of the YM and YWHA Poetry Center, 92nd Street and Lexington Avenue, John Malcolm Brennan, director. Monday night at the famed Teresa L. Kaufman Auditorium, the Poetry Center presents the distinguished English writer Aldous Huxley. And on Saturday night, April 10th at 8, the Poetry Center will present a concert performance of Shakespeare's King John. Tickets are still available for this exciting reading, which commemorates the 390th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth. Anthology is produced by Steve White, written and directed by Draper Lewis. Until next Sunday at 3, this is Fleetwood wishing you good luck and good reading.